Hello, it's Friday, May 5th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Wing TV is back on the air after nearly a week's time. Lisa, we've been gone for a while, huh?
Yeah, we got emailed by some people wondering if we're okay, if we took a few days off. No, I can say we definitely didn't take a few days off. And yes, we are okay.
Yeah, we're back on the air now. What we did for the last week or so was go on a massive road trip. We put on almost 1,400 miles. And anyone who listened to our show on Sunday realizes that we went to New York City for the massive anti-war rally there. After we got back, we traveled down to Shanksville, Pennsylvania for 2 days investigating Flight 93.
We also hit New Baltimore, Pennsylvania, and Indian Lake.
Correct. And then for the last 2 days, we went up to Ohio, went to Kent State University for the 36th anniversary of the Kent State shootings.
Right. We participated in a candlelight vigil with hundreds of other people. And it was a pretty intense week. We're kind of exhausted.
Right. So it's good to be home. Believe us, when you're on the road that many miles, that many days, it's good to see the front door again. So what we're going to do is kind of start off again in New York City. We recounted that on our Sunday show, but there are a few more developments. The mainstream media, of course, reports that there were only tens of thousands of people there. And when I actually went to get the New York Times on Sunday, I tried to find an article on this rally, this march. And I went through about the first 20 pages of the front section. This is the big Sunday edition. I couldn't find any articles. Finally, somebody told us that it was on page 36. They buried it that deep into the paper. And the actual numbers came in now, and they're saying anywhere from 300,000 to 350,000 people there.
Yeah, kind of weird that the New York Times would bury a story like that when it was a massive, enormous protest.
Yeah, and here's the New York Times, supposedly this liberal, left-wing bastion, anti-war media outlet. Yet here's the biggest anti-war demonstration probably since the 1960s. And they bury it on page 36?
Right.
What does that tell you?
It tells me a lot. What we're happy about, too, is to see that our World Trade Center-controlled demolition banner got into an MSNBC photo of the march. You have to look, but you can see that what it says if you look closely. And I think Victor put it up on our homepage.
Yeah, if you go to the second lead article in the right-hand column, you'll see the just massive throng of people. And towards the bottom of this photograph, you'll see a long red, white, and blue banner. And that's the World Trade Center 9/11 controlled demolition banner.
We were there in the thick of it.
That's right. So so that's where our journey started. We got back real late Saturday night from that, 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Got a little bit of sleep on Sunday, did this show. Then got up early Monday morning and traveled to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, of course.
Well, first we hit New Baltimore.
Right, right. So, yeah, when we went down there, we had a certain game plan. And anyone that reads Phantom Flight 93 knows that in this book we prove that Flight 93 or something purporting to be Flight 93 didn't crash land in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We have a much different theory in saying that the plane was actually brought out of the sky and crash-landed somewhere near New Baltimore, Pennsylvania. So we started in this little town, and as we say in this book, the population of New Baltimore is 160 people. 160. Now, I think that's a liberal estimate.
What we saw in New Baltimore was a very scenic, very densely wooded, mountainous little burg.
Right.
Wouldn't you say that's pretty much what it was? It was a place like, it was a beautiful place, and not that many people, it appears, live there at all.
What you have to do to get there is first, you have to go on to this old country road. And then from this country road, you take New Baltimore Road, which you go down into a gully, basically,
and
6 or 7
descending
miles.
Descending for miles.
Yeah, for miles and miles. We were joking that this was like being in the Deliverance movie. You remember when they're going to the middle of nowhere? And so finally, after 6 or 7 miles of going down there, you see this little town down there. And it's essentially just two roads that run parallel to each other that have a few people. I mean, there's no hotels, there's no diners.
Little is too big.
Yeah.
Tiny town.
No red lights, no anything. I mean, it just is a few houses.
No gas station.
So we talked to a few people down there, very open about what they thought happened. And people telling us about seeing a variety of aircrafts in the sky that morning, talking openly about this plane being shot down.
Yes, they actually have, the people in New Baltimore really do believe something other than what the government puts forth actually happened on 9/11 there.
Yeah, so we visited the post office, saw a couple of people milling around out in their yards, then visited a church, talked to a woman who was quoted in Phantom Flight 93.
Right, Melanie.
Yeah, Melanie. And Hankinson. She was telling us about how not only were they finding pieces of the aircraft floating through the sky, parts of the seat cushions and so forth, and also
the seat backings.
Seat backings, and also different mail. But she said that
checks.
The FBI set up a little outpost there.
Right.
So that they could go around and collect all of this material.
And the locals there were handing in bags of debris that they recovered from their properties to the FBI at this little trailer.
Right. And Melanie also said that she found a piece of metal that later was identified as a part of the underbelly of the plane.
Identified by the FBI.
Right. Now, this is very interesting because if you go by roads from Shanksville to New Baltimore, it's anywhere from 6 to 8 miles. As they say, as the crow flies, it's only about 4 miles. So, if something crash lands in Shanksville, how is all of this material going to land in New Baltimore, especially when we, as we say in the book, the wind speed that morning was only 9 to 10 miles an hour. Now, do you think it's going to take little pieces of the underbelly of the plane, the wind at 9 or 10 miles an hour, it's going to carry it at the minimum 4 miles through the air?
Well, and you'd have to see the area to see how many trees, the forest that's there, the mountain, the you know, the landscape isn't flat. It rises to a pretty steep altitude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is almost so dense and so thick, these mountains here, and there's hundreds and hundreds of square miles of them. I mean, all it is just a wooded area. That this is almost too thick for hunting, too steep. You know, it's just not the type of area that lends itself really to anything other than intense hiking, I guess. You know, the most intense hikers would go in there.
Some fishing.
Yeah. So, after leaving New Baltimore, then we went up to Indian Lake, which also plays a very crucial part in the whole Flight 93 legend, because there we find that people were actually finding human body parts washing up on shore the day after 9/11.
People telling us about what seemed to be buckets of gravel landing on the roof of their homes. People who lived 1 to 1.5 miles away reporting this type of gravel on the roofs of their homes.
Correct. Also, we talked to a woman who worked at a private country club at Indian Lake, and she was telling us how she saw this airline or something, 93 or something, purporting to be 93, flying in. And then she said her first impression was that she thought there was a bomb on board.
Right.
Because it was coming in along the tree line on a descent, and then all of a sudden it just dropped.
It
straight
went vertical
down.
And nosedived.
Yeah, and she said that she thought there was a bomb on board, which is also very interesting. And so we talked to a variety of other people. They said that, yes, there was debris or wreckage from Flight 93, from this aircraft, washing up on the shores of Indian Lake at the marina. People there also finding parts from the airliner in their yards.
And we asked all these people, too. We showed them a diagram Victor made of the dimensions of the plane and then the dimensions of the hole that it was said to have crash-landed in.
Right.
And we asked them if they found it odd that this huge, enormous airliner could crash into this tiny hole.
Yeah. Well, what it is in this diagram is Flight 93 would have been, if this was an actual 757, 150 feet long. So that's half a football field, okay? The wings would have stretched almost the width of the football field, about two-thirds of it. So we have something that's 255,000 pounds, over a quarter of a million pounds, and it's supposed to all be consumed in a 10-foot by 10-foot by 18-foot deep hole. Now, how can that be, a quarter of a million pounds in a 10-foot hole?
And to be honest, the people in New Baltimore and Indian Lake were more open to actually thinking about this and questioning the official version than the people we met in Shanksville.
Right. And this is what we noticed, that the closer we got to the crux of this event, the closer we got to Shanksville and to the official sources, the less apt or the less willing people were to talk about anything other than
the official version. Very guarded.
Yeah. And we noticed this first when we spoke to a woman named Valencia McClatchy.
Right. She runs a local real estate business there in Shanksville.
Right. And she is the woman who took the famous photo of the mushroom cloud ascending up over the tree line and up over a barn.
I'm sure many of you have seen it. It's the picture with the red barn.
Right.
With the big big gray mushroom cloud in the background.
Yeah, and that's we have a thumbnail version of this on the cover of Phantom Flight 93. Well, we called her up, met with her at her real estate office, and within a matter of 5 minutes, would you say,
we were
kicked out of her office.
She threw us out of her office.
Yeah.
She had lightning coming out of her eyes.
Yeah.
She was sneering. She actually made the statement that she didn't want to be around any people who questioned the government.
Right. And she was also very upset that we used this thumbnail, literally the size of a thumbnail version of her photograph, because it's copyrighted and she has a big lawsuit against the Associated Press, and it looked like she wants to make her payday. She wants to strike
Let me clarify. We got that photo off of public domain. We didn't go onto anyone's website to get the photo. It's all over the place. If you Google various Shanksville keywords, you can come up with that photo. And we tried to explain this to Ms. McClatchy, that once a photo gets onto the public domain, you know, it's pretty hard to contain it. And she's very angry. She's very bitter. And she comes across as an opportunist.
Well, and also, as Lisa said, she wouldn't entertain even the slightest possibility that there was anything that happened out of the ordinary other than what the government said, their official version.
Well, that photo is apparently Ms. McClatchy's claim to fame,
right.
And she's going to ride this puppy all the way to the end and hopefully make some big bucks off that photo.
Yeah.
That photo was everywhere in Shanksville.
Yeah, oh, everywhere. Also, we went up and visited the memorial, Flight 93 memorial. And when we say memorial, that's stretching it. What it is, essentially, was a wooden shack that's so small that at the most you could put six people in there at one time, packed very, very tightly. After 4.5 years, this is all that they've built up there yet, is a wooden shack that's half the size of my shed out in the backyard.
I'd say it's about the size of our bathroom.
Yeah, it's the size of a bathroom. And then there's a chain link fence where people were hanging different hats and little banners
and
so forth.
And then there's these little wooden dollies on sticks stuck into the ground to represent each of the alleged passengers on the plane.
Yeah, and a couple benches, and that's it. Across the distance, maybe, I don't even know distance-wise.
Well, surrounding this is a very large green field.
Yeah.
And then there's a chain link fence with a flag erected on it.
Yeah, and then you see the place where supposedly Flight 93 crash landed. Well, nobody's allowed in there, of course. No one's. It's completely barricaded from the public, but you can see it with the eye. But what this basically is there's nothing there except for a little shack out in this massive steep field in the middle of nowhere. We talked to the ambassador there.
Bob Schmucker is his name.
Yeah, he was regurgitating the same official line, but he told us at one point that the entire fuselage was pulled from this crater. He said it was down to a depth of 48 feet, and it was crinkled up like aluminum foil.
Right.
Yet, inside the shack where they had a color book of photos from the day, it said on there that the crater was only 18 feet deep. So how can the crater be 18 feet deep, yet the fuselage supposedly is 48 feet deep?
Yeah, we asked him a lot of questions, and he became very, very
befuddled, I'd say.
Yeah, and he said we need to go talk to various other people because he couldn't answer our questions, and he thought they were very valid questions.
Right.
Just to let you know, they have filled in the crater. They've covered that over. There's a mound behind it, supposedly with ground tree limbs, and we were told by this Mr. Schmucker that Wally Miller, the coroner at Shanksville, had said that it was a mixture of human remains and ground tree limbs, and we wondered why they would leave human remains, if that's the case, above ground, since in some reports it said that some tissue samples couldn't be identified because of weather degradation. It kind of seems bizarro that they would leave human remains above ground like that on a mound.
Now here's what we also found very interesting is because not only did every person that we speak to, and we spoke with dozens and dozens of people down there, every single person gave a different version of what they saw that day. But what they seemed to want it both ways. When we would ask people why there was no wreckage visible in photographs taken immediately after this event, they'd say, well, you don't understand. This plane was coming in at, and then we'd hear 300, 400, 500, 600,
we heard about
even
six,
700 miles an hour.
Six or seven rates of speed, supposedly, that Flight 93 was traveling at. It was sort of like, you know, the old fish tail where the fish gets bigger as you go down the line from the next person to the next person.
So they would say, well, you don't understand. Coming in at that speed, it just went completely into the hole. It was consumed.
Right.
But then we'd say, well, what about the, you know, what
the
about
debris,
the debris? What about human remains? And I'd say, oh, well, you know, there were human remains all through the trees behind there.
Uh-huh.
And there was engines there and parts of wreckage and so forth. So I was looking at a photo at the hospital, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But one of the photographs there, you had the trees in the backline. And if you get Phantom Flight 93, it's a perfect picture of what we're talking about. Anyway, it finally hit me as like everybody kept saying that the human remains and the wreckage was all in the trees there,
right,
which would make it obscured from the photographs, but there was nothing in the field in front of it or to the sides of it.
In other words, all of the debris that got ejected upon impact only went onto the tree line side and not on any of the other sides. The other three sides had no debris whatsoever.
Yeah, very conveniently. And people would explain, they'd say, well, you know, with all that massive amount of fuel inside the plane, when it hit, it exploded, and that's how you got the human remains and the wreckage. But picture it like this. If somebody dropped a bomb in your yard, don't you think when it blew up, that it would be symmetrical. It would explode in all directions. Yet at Flight 93 here, we're supposed to believe that it only exploded in one direction, conveniently, into the trees where no photographers could see anything.
Right.
Doesn't it seem not to add up?
And of course, none of the photos show the debris that they're talking about.
Right.
So it kind of it leaves it to your imagination. You have to imagine that there were body parts in the trees, hanging from the trees, as these people all claim there were.
And one other thing we noticed was that it's like there was this massive myth or legend that's been created because nobody actually ever saw anything there.
Right.
We said, well, how do you know that? Well, somebody told me this.
Right.
So what you're doing is, it seems like one official story was created right away, and it was spread throughout the community. And we talked to somebody at the volunteer fire department in Somerset, and he said he was amazed at how quickly the FBI was on the scene.
Yes, in fact, his words were, it seemed as if they already knew what was going on, what was going down, what was happening when they got there. Kind of reminds you of the Wellstone incident.
Right, Paul Wellstone. So as soon as the FBI got there, they immediately cleared everybody else out.
Oh, let me mention
took
something
control
else
of the scene
about Valencia McClatchy. She says she took this infamous photo from her house a mile away from the crash site in Shanksville. And conveniently, she had her camera sitting right by the front door and ran outside and took this picture, which kind of begs the question, what kind of a photo camera can take a picture from a mile away with such clarity? She's a realtor, so realtors just basically use their cameras for taking pictures of houses and rooms inside houses. It's kind of curious.
Yeah. So after that, then we approached another very infamous figure in the whole Flight 93 case, that's Wally Miller,
right.
The coroner.
Right. The Wally Miller is also a funeral director, and he runs a funeral home in Shanksville, and he is the point man. He is the man who knows everything, I guess, there is to know about the human remains and the wreckage, since he was in charge of the crime scene and held on to the evidence, whatever evidence there was, till, I think, 2004 or 2005.
Yeah.
Before he handed it over.
Well, we went to his funeral parlor, and it's very tiny. There was no other cars in the parking lot other than ours. We were the only car there. We went upstairs, looked all around. There was no one there. So we were going to leave. We didn't think he was there, but I finally went up and knocked at a side door.
Now, wait. Before we talked to him, we walked through the funeral home because the door was unlocked, mm-hmm. and we walked in. All the lights are off in the funeral home. Not a soul is around. There's no chapel set up for any kind of viewings. Nobody's name on the front directory. Nothing to show that there's anything going to be going on there that day.
Yeah. So we knock at the door. He comes out, and we asked him if we could talk to him for a couple minutes, and he was very much like he didn't want to speak to us at all.
Very agitated, and people urged us to speak to him. Yeah. Many people did.
It was almost like he was tipped off
that
we were coming, and he gave us maybe at most 3 minutes of his time. And just, he was like, he was too busy, too consumed with business and blah, blah, blah. Yet, nobody inside the funeral home, no cars in the parking lot, but he was so consumed that he couldn't talk to us.
He wasn't dressed for any type of viewing. He had very casual clothes, jeans on. And one thing he did say, he didn't want to discuss the United 93 movie. He seemed pretty angry about that. And we weren't planning on asking him about the movie. And then I asked him about the human remains and the wreckage because we'd spoken to a Vicky Rock at the Daily American newspaper in Somerset. And she said that they hadn't identified all of the remains from Flight 93. Well, I asked him about that comment, and he said he waved his hand and he made a face and he said, no, they were all identified. Everybody was identified. So it's kind of curious, the contradiction there.
Yeah, and then we also spoke to another one of the first responders who was very nervous, and it was like his eyes were going everywhere when we were speaking.
He kept looking around to see who was watching him talk to us.
Yeah, and then finally we went up to the hospital, and we wanted to speak to the communications director who was in charge.
Media relations.
Yeah, media relations that day. And
Greg Cipelli.
Yes, he came out and gave us maybe 3 minutes of his time and basically said that he couldn't even speak to us until he found out more about Wing TV, what Wing TV was, since he'd never heard of us.
Right, he had to check us out first.
Yeah, so we thought, well, what does this matter who we are? We just want to ask him some questions.
But what he did tell us is that they received no bodies at that hospital from the Flight 93 crash.
Right.
So without even realizing that he gave us a little piece of information there, he did actually tell us something.
Yeah, so since we got back late last night, next week Lisa's going to call Wally Miller on the phone, talk to him, maybe Greg Cipelli also, and just find us out. The last thing we did, we also went to the state police in Somerset.
Curiously, they didn't deny that there may have been an area cordoned off.
Right.
Remember, Brian Cabell of CNN established that an area in New Baltimore, Pennsylvania, had been cordoned off by the FBI.
And the state police.
This state police officer that we spoke with said, well, I can't say that there wasn't an area cordoned off because we went wherever there was debris reported.
Right.
And he said the FBI had basically been the ones in charge of everything. They were the information gatherers, and once they came on the scene, they kicked pretty much everybody else off.
Yeah, and we asked if there were any official police reports filed. None were filed, of course. No, we didn't file any reports. Everything was done by the FBI in Johnstown. So we actually journeyed up to Johnstown after we were done the second day, but the FBI office had been moved yet again to another place.
Weird? What was weird is nobody there seemed to know that the FBI had moved their offices.
Yeah,
even the police there.
Right next door.
Right next door told us to go into a building where they used to be, but apparently didn't realize they were no longer there. It was kind of weird that they wouldn't know.
Yeah, so what it boiled down to in Shanksville was that the further away you got from the crux of this matter,
the more people openly questioned the official version.
Right. They were more willing to speak, more at ease. And the closer you got, the more uptight, nervous, dismissive.
Agitated.
Yeah, they were. And it made us very wonder. It's like
paranoid.
It almost seemed like they had a vested interest
right.
in keeping the official story alive, because since the United 93 movie came out, the movie studio has already pledged $1.4 million.
They're supposed to get the 10% of the proceeds, I
guess. Yeah, to build this new memorial. So the people in Shanksville have a vested interest in keeping this official story alive, because it's going to bring tourists into their city.
It's going to boost their local economy.
Right, construction firms and on and on and
mm-hmm.
on. So, as we said, the closer to the official sources we got, the more they didn't want to talk about it. So
yeah,
we're going to keep following up.
Yeah, we're not finished with this. We're going to be going back there, and we're going to be... Wally Miller did say he would speak to us on the phone, so we're going to follow up with him, too.
Right. So, after we got back from that trip, we jumped in the car again the next morning.
Yep.
And went out to Kent, Ohio, which is home of Kent State University. And 36 years ago yesterday, it was the infamous Kent State Massacre. The Kent State shootings, where National Guard forces opened fire
on, I guess, a crowd of students who were protesting.
Right.
And four students were killed and many others were injured.
Yeah, and this is a very pivotal event, as we were discussing yesterday coming home, because after this shooting on the Kent State campus, it pretty much did an end to campus protests, very radical campus protests in the United States, because the student bodies basically across the country said, these guys are serious now. Now they're opening fire on us. They're taking
right.
their
what
weapons.
What they did was send a message and end what was more than just some students protesting at Kent. I mean, back then, they were really getting radicalized.
Yeah.
They were really confronting the government. They didn't want any more of this type of confrontation. And so with the shooting of those four students, they virtually ended that type of protest.
Right. What happened to show how far they were taking things back then is the students... This was after the invasion of Cambodia. The students started having these spontaneous rallies, their protests. And at one point, they surrounded the ROTC building on the campus of Kent State and set it on fire. And it went out a couple times. It was reignited, and they ended up burning this building to the ground.
But what we heard was that they still don't know who set that fire.
Right.
That the students even were wondering who set that fire.
Yeah, and nobody's convinced it actually was the students.
Right.
It could have been some kind of outside agitator or a plant that did it. But what happened then was that the governor of Ohio declared a state of emergency. They sent the National Guard in. They read the Riot Act. And then on May 4th, there were some more protests. There were maybe 1,500 students. The National Guard got into a formation, started pushing the students back away from where they were protesting. They went up a hill, and the guards actually pulled their guns and directed them at the students. Then at one point, when the students dispersed across the parking lot, the National Guard turned around
and started to withdraw and
retreated. But then, out of nowhere, they turned back around
again. About 10 of them, turned back around and opened fire on the students.
Right. They fired 67 shots
right.
in a span of 13 seconds. Four students were killed, 11 other wounded.
And I believe they said that it was confirmed that a shoot order was given.
Yeah. And nobody still has taken responsibility
for... Nobody's been held accountable for these murders.
Right, for giving the orders. There was investigations, I guess, within the next 4 or 5 years afterwards. No one was ever held accountable. No one ever imprisoned.
Well, I guess Nixon called the protesters, the students, bums and
yeah.
terrorists. And if you would have listened to the speeches we listened to, people speaking on behalf of these murdered students, there, you know, you don't come away thinking these were bums and terrorists.
Well, and as a matter of fact, of the four students,
very moving.
Of the four students killed, three of them were protesting. The fourth
was just going to class.
He was walking from one class to another. He was walking across this parking lot. He was actually a ROTC member.
Right.
And he was walking from one class to the next, and he was one of the people killed by by the National Guard. And what really struck us was that you see the anti-war movement today, and they're, you know, we have to stop the war, blah, 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 but they're not willing to go to the lengths that the kids and the protesters were back in the late 60s and early 70s. Right. They were actually throwing stones at the police officers, burning buildings down.
Starting riots.
Very, very radicalized.
Well, it sent a very strong message, and that Kent State shooting cast a long, long shadow. And I think it has helped define and shape how people protest today, because they realize that our government is willing to, and the military is willing to shoot at its own people.
Yeah. And
in certain situations.
And there's a big difference. And I did a radio interview Wednesday, actually from Kent State, on Visigoths from the Grassy Knoll, and described how different the situation is today in terms of trying to stop the war now compared to the late 60s. And one of the things that the government learned was that they'll do anything to prevent reinstating the draft. Because right now, on college campuses across America, none of them have a vested interest in this because their lives aren't directly at stake. Back then, they could get a letter in the mail and say, in 4 weeks, you're going to be dropped in the jungles of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since there's no draft, none of the kids have any risk of going into the military unless they sign up themselves.
Yeah,
this is a volunteer military.
We're not going to defeat this enemy with peace and love and singing in the streets and yelling out little rhymes at protests. We're going to have to realize at some point that power does not concede unless it's forced to do so.
Right. And even though we are very, very proud and honored to be a part of that massive march in New York City, 300,000 plus people, we also realized out of Kent State that the government's not going to willingly just stop the war
right.
because people don't like it.
Right.
You know, they were radicalized back then.
And one guy who spoke at the anniversary in Kent said that we need to stop this war by whatever means it takes,
yeah.
whatever's necessary. And I wondered if he really meant that.
Yeah,
he said that. Because that's what they were doing in the 60s.
Yeah, and they meant it back then.
They made an impact.
Right, and, you know, it's a different time now. And all of us have to ask ourselves, we're against this administration. We're against the New World Order. We hate this god-awful war in Iraq and Afghanistan and possibly beyond. How far are we willing to go to actually stop it?
Right. And we can't stress enough. You want to end this war, then you need to challenge this administration on what they don't want to be challenged on. And that's what led to the war. The lies of 9/11, the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center towers, all the lies from all the purported plane crashes. You need to challenge and attack them on what they don't want to be challenged and attacked on.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a whirlwind trip, like we said, almost 1,400 miles, just endless miles on the interstates and country roads and in between a lot of little diners.
I'll tell you what, there's a lot more questioning minds out there than the mainstream media would have you believe. There are people mulling this situation with 9/11 over and over in their heads, and we saw it in New Baltimore, we saw it in Indian Lake.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it in Kent.
Right.
I mean, and we had open discussions about 9/11 and the controlled demolition at Kent State, and people there are hip to what's going on, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'd also like to thank Patriot Jim Kujua, who came along with us on this trip, and everybody, Carl Robinson, who hosted us up there in Kent State, Ohio, and everybody that we spoke to along the way. There were literally just dozens and dozens of people everywhere that we talked to, got their ideas and opinions, and we're going to talk more about this on Monday and as time goes on, but we wanted to give you a brief overview of what we're doing and remind everybody that this September 11th, the fifth anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, we've been talking to people. Everybody says they're going to go. We have to now hold them to it and get everybody up there to show that we're not going to tolerate the lies of this event.
Well, and for all the people calling for justice and peace, We tell you again, you cannot have either one of those things without having truth first. You just can't.
That's right. So we'd like to thank everybody for tuning in. If we don't email back to you, I had
1,200 emails in my inbox.
And 500 or 600 on my end. So we have almost 2,000 emails. So if you have something to say, send us a new email, because I'm sure
we're
the other
ones... still trying to play catch-up.
Yeah, they're buried in the old ones. We're going to be back Monday, normal broadcast schedule. We'll have all new updated articles at that time. And go out and enjoy your weekend. And also, though, get involved and spread the truth about what's going on, because it keeps growing. The awareness about what's happening in this country grows on a daily basis. And
we have to follow that up with action, right, or it's meaningless.
Until Monday, keep your eyes open, because there's a lot going on.
See you all then.